Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. We'll start this morning with a look at some of the big stories that are developing this week. WYPR's Kenneth Burns and Fraser Smith join me to talk about what's ahead in the Freddie Gray trials and what we can expect as Democrats take the stage in their first presidential primary debate tomorrow night. Then, Marvin Pinkert on the Jewish Museum of Maryland's new exhibition, Straight from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that explores the work of the iconic singer-songwriter Paul Simon. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be here, too, with her review of the new production at Baltimore's Annex Theater. And the author Ann Tyler has been nominated for a Man Booker Prize for her latest novel. The winner will be announced tomorrow. This morning, Ann Tyler talks about A Spool of Blue Thread. Lots of good stuff going on today. Glad you're with us. We'll start with the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning on this special Columbus Day edition of the program. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Of course, if we were in Alaska or Hawaii or South Dakota, there would be no Columbus Day celebration. They don't celebrate it. There's a fairly controversial figure, Columbus. So Albuquerque, Portland, Seattle, no Columbus Day. But here in Baltimore, we do have Columbus Day. If you have the day off, I hope you're enjoying it. We are going to be talking a little bit about some of the news that's coming up this week with our good friend P. Kenneth Burns from the WYPR News Department. Good morning, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
And Fraser Smith, our senior news analyst and columnist for the Daily Record. Good to see you as always.
Good to be here, Tom.
Plenty of stuff going on this week, Kenny. You have been following the Freddie Gray machinations pre-trial. The first trial isn't scheduled until the 30th of November. Officer Porter is the first officer to be tried, but there's plenty of stuff going on beforehand. Tomorrow and Wednesday, Judge Williams has scheduled some hearings to discuss some motions. What do you expect?
Well, we expect them to be decisively handled. If anything, from what I've observed from Judge Barry Williams, who's been overseeing the proceedings since the first trial or first motion hearings in September, is he doesn't have a whole lot. He doesn't allow a whole lot of foolishness, to say the least, to come before him. In fact, after he decided not to recuse the state's attorney's office or Marilyn Mosby or drop the charges, he read the Riot Act to both sides, telling them, look, I want to see the legal arguments. I don't want to see the rhetoric or the fight for sound bites. We do not know what motions will be discussed this week. We won't know until we show up, but we do know that Tuesday and Wednesday there will be motion hearings on those 2 days.
And a couple of the things that are sort of issues that are still lying out there, one of which is to whether or not they can suppress the statements that the officers made, because the defense is arguing that they were made, they were obtained outside of legal limits. Do you think that's one of the things that he may pick up this week?
That's a possibility. The defense for Officer Porter tried to seek a reconsideration moving the trials out of Baltimore because of media coverage, specifically the Baltimore Sun and surrounding those statements. So it could be a possibility that you might be able to have those statements suppressed or what have you because of media coverage. It's a completely different argument and a completely different issue. But for the meantime, the trials are still going to stay in Baltimore. But how will that media coverage deal? How will they affect what's been obtained by prosecutors?
Yeah, a very interesting piece of Justin George's yesterday in the Baltimore Sun, where he was embedded with the police as they did their investigation, as it turns out, in a parallel fashion to State's Attorney Mosby's office. Interesting stuff. And Fraser Smith, you've been doing a series on Pigtown in Southeast Baltimore, this is an interesting topic about what's going on down there and the involvement of the University of Maryland. We did a piece here on Maryland Morning few days ago about what Hopkins and Morgan are doing in the community. Hopkins has this new initiative called Hopkins Local. And, the president of Morgan has appointed a task force at Morgan State to see how the university as an institution can help the city rebuild and move forward, particularly in light of what happened last April. What are you finding down there in Southeast Baltimore? Where is it? Southwest? I've got my...
Excuse me, Tom. Yes, it's Southwest. It's Southwest Baltimore.
It's right near University of Maryland.
Right.
Down it's on the other side of Martin Luther King Boulevard. Right.
Exactly. It's an unusual pairing of a neighborhood, seven of them, with the power player, the anchor institution of the University of Maryland, Baltimore. It's very unusual sort of partnership. They've raised something like $200,000 already to develop the neighborhoods, and our interest has been to see whether it's possible to think of a template for other neighborhood developments, particularly now after Freddie Gray and looking at Sandtown, which is one of the most deprived neighborhoods in the city, to see if any of the elements of neighborhood growth and sort of power updating or adding some power to a place like Sandtown, which doesn't have an adjacent university to pair up with. But there are other things that are there. But I went to an event on Saturday just 2 days ago where the university is starting something called a CURE program, where they're finding talented kids in the sixth and seventh grades, hoping that they can get them on a track to qualify for jobs in the new biopark down there, instead of grass cutting and cleaning bathrooms and things like that. Real jobs with real pay is the kind of institutional investment that I don't think exists anymore. I mean,
and they're identifying these kids in the sixth and seventh grade. It's not like they're waiting until they graduate from college and say, "Oh, here's a biotech job."
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, so maybe people in this neighborhood would not have been qualified otherwise. But there were 47 kids there, with 100 mentors from Morgan and Hopkins and other universities in the city, trying to get them ready to do this. I mean, it's just one of the things that they're doing down there.
Yeah, there's certain things that, you know, that only these large institutions like Maryland and Hopkins and Morgan have the capacity to do in terms of moving lots of the balls forward rather than one or two at a time.
Well, when you look at what has happened in Sandtown, for example, after Freddie Gray's death and all the focus, not much has happened governmentally. So you have this really unique thing that's developing now where the private sector is stepping in to do things that formerly were done by government.
Yeah, indeed. Fraser Smith from the WIPR News Department, our senior news analyst and columnist for the Daily Record. P. Kenneth Burns is with me as well from the news department here at WIPR. Kenny, you've been following for some time now the 9/11 call center story at the city of Baltimore. It has been moved just recently, or is in the process of being moved, from the sort of tech department to the fire department. What's going on with that?
Well, it's interesting because when the 911 operators and the police dispatchers were moved from the police department to the mayor's office of information technology, the mayor's office recently, as a couple of weeks ago, said that this was a national best practice. But when I spoke with Randy Griffin at Georgetown University, he says more of a trend than a best practice, because you have towns across the country trying to sort of consolidate their tech departments with, you know, if you have similar technologies, have them in the same room and they could probably fix stuff faster. But his concern is that the camaraderie, the human cost that is lost when you do a move like that, because we're still dealing with public safety and you're still dealing with real lives. So this was reported in the Sun late Friday, this move from MOIT, as the information technology department is called, to a combination of police and fire. All of the operators are going to be under the fire department, and the police and fire departments are going to dispatch their own individual calls. And this is because of longstanding issues with 911. They had a big tech outage last year, and then even to this day, you still have issues with drop calls and busy signals. And overall, Tom, the operators were under... they're short-staffed.
Right.
They're 77.
They're frantically training people now to take some of these jobs.
Right. In fact, they cut their training down to, I believe, 4 months off the top of my head. And The city has been training 10 more operators since July. They're expected to be on the job after next month. And then there's plans to hire up to 10 more early next year. The other issue, and this was raised by Yvonne Rice, City Union of Baltimore. They represent the operators. Apparently, 911 operators, after their shift, have been taking 311 calls outside of their emergency calls. I've sent an email to Howard Libet ask if this is the case, and I have not gotten an affirmative answer back yet.
All right, well, we will stay with you on that to find out, because that's an interesting development. The mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rollins-Blake, who is also the head of the U.S. Mayor's Conference, was at the National Press Club last week in Washington. Here's a little bit of what she had to say at that event.
The unrest and our response was a stark reminder that Baltimore was not as prepared as we should have been and certainly could have been for those for the unrest. And we're making significant improvements when it comes to communication, when it comes to training and equipment. I don't think anyone would have expected the unrest to unfold in the way that it did. But what it did give us was an opportunity to strengthen our response, to strengthen our training, and to be better prepared. And I'm pleased to say that I've seen a lot of improvement in the way that we've handled the potential unrest that has happened since.
Fraser Smith, the mayor is representing the U.S. Conference of Mayors, yet she is still dogged and hounded, as it were, by questions about her handling of the riots in April. Is this attenuating her effectiveness as a leader of the Conference of Mayors, the fact that she's been, sort of pegged with this?
Kenny's probably more up to date on the conference than I am, but I think that these positions are mostly honorary anyway, and I think the kind of leadership you can show is not all that important. I listened to a little bit of her remarks as well, and I think she was quite engaging, actually, and she told some jokes and people laughed, and it's the kind of thing I wish she had done more of when she was the mayor.
Yeah,
I mean, she still is the mayor, of course.
Yeah, right.
She's still the mayor, but you know, she's
17
the
months.
Acting
yeah.
mayor.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, we didn't get a chance to talk about Martin O'Malley and his big make or break evening tomorrow night, but we will be talking about it on Wednesday morning here on Maryland Morning. Well, P. Kenneth Burns, Fraser Smith, many thanks. Appreciate you. See you
Thank
guys
you for
later.
Having me.
Good to be with you.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. Mr. Sterner, it's all yours.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
When I was in college studying classical music, I paid my way through school as a lounge lizard. I played guitar and sang in bars across upstate New York, and one of my most vivid memories of my freshman year is spending an afternoon listening to a Paul Simon song, trying to figure it out. It was this song.
You got the cool water when the fever runs high. You got the look of love light in your eyes. And I was in crazy motion till you calmed me down. It took a little time, but you calmed me down.
It's one of the great love songs of all time, Something So Right. And for me, in 1973, transcribing it off the record was a crowning achievement of my late adolescence. There's a sophistication and elegance to the writing in this wonderful ballad, like so many of Paul Simon's songs, that continues to amaze and delight millions of music fans around the world. Paul Simon has been writing songs since the 1950s, and he's still at it, writing with a command of his craft that places him, at least in my estimation, in the ranks of Mozart, Schubert, Gershwin, Lennon, McCartney, and a handful of others that we might place at the pinnacle of the songwriting art. The Jewish Museum of Maryland has an exhibition that chronicles Paul Simon's amazing career and his unparalleled contribution to the world of music. It's called simply Paul Simon, Words and Music. Marvin Pinkert is the Jewish Museum's director, and he joins me in the studio. Good morning, Marvin. Thanks
Good
for
morning.
Coming by.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
So this exhibition is really terrific. One of the first things you see when you walk in is a passport to England, Paul Simon's Passport. They had he and Simon and Garfunkel had come up with an album called Wednesday Morning 3 a.m. It was not a big success.
No, I believe they only sold a few thousand of these.
Yeah, and then Paul Simon goes to England, and Art Garfunkel actually goes to visit him a little later. Simon and Garfunkel almost didn't
happen at all.
Yeah.
You know, they thought, gee, this is not going to work out. There isn't an audience for our music. And while they're over there, their producer at Columbia Records, Tom Wilson, decides he'd just put the electronics under Bob Dylan's music and said, well, what if I took Sounds of Silence and put an electronic track underneath it? Didn't bother to tell Simon and Garfunkel that he was doing this. The album, the record started to rise up the charts, and all of a sudden they found themselves, after first resisting the idea, saying, this is pretty great. And they rushed into the studio in the 50 years ago this winter, and that's when they recorded Sounds of Silence, the album that would be their takeoff.
Yeah, that was their second album. It's, you know, Simon and Garfunkel is such an iconic pairing, such an iconic group. They were really only playing together for about 7 years. They did just five records together, although it seems like...
The exhibit has a timeline of Simon's career in it, and you look at this career that spans six decades, and you see this little span of 6 years, which is Simon and Garfunkel. And as he says in one of the videos in the exhibit, someday people may say, Simon and Garfunkel was how Paul Simon started his career.
Yeah, yeah. One of the fun things is that there's a great insight into his songwriting process. You have these snippets of ideas that he scribbled in various places. There's a magazine that has some lyrics scribbled in it, and he's
writing down
all other different
right.
Place.
Yeah. He's writing down a workman's wages, working only for workman's wages, and that of course eventually becomes part of The Boxer. You see that the ideas often come out in small phrases, and it isn't as though he sits down and writes the entire song in one fell swoop. These are actually crafted out of phrases that resonate for him.
And of course, sometimes the lyrics happened a little bit, not just serendipitously, but sort of crazily. I mean, lie.
He confesses that he had originally planned to fill that in. That was all just like Greeking
It was a placeholder
while they were doing the lyrics. And turned out he liked it, so he kept it.
He kept it in there. This is a beautiful tune that he wrote called An American Tune.
Many's the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused.
Now, when I say he wrote this, he did, of course, write it, but it's taken right from Johann Sebastian Bach. This is based on a chorale from the St. Matthew Passion called O Haupt voll Blut und Wunden, which is translated in English, O Sacred Head Now Wounded. This is an amazing thing for a pop singer to be appropriating Bach chorales, isn't it?
It is amazing. And when I went to look and I thought, gee, that's kind of unusual. Where does a Bach chorale come from? Turns out that Bach had borrowed it from a German tune that existed two centuries before Bach, and it had been about, it was a love song about being confused when your lover leaves you, which of course is exactly where Paul Simon's lyrics begin. So it turns out that there's even, it's like that old pizza roll commercial about stealing the William Tell Overture.
Mm-hmm.
There's always someone else who's
someone stole it first. Yeah, that's right. Fascinating stuff. You talk about the exhibit has a bit about the famous movie The Graduate, and Mike Nichols, the director, commissioned a few tunes from Simon and Garfunkel for that movie and almost didn't get them.
Well, he was supposed to, in addition to three songs that he had already written, he was supposed to write three new pieces of music. And one of them, he walks into the studio with a song about Mrs. Roosevelt. And Mike Nichols turns to him and says, the character is Mrs. Robinson. And so they redrafted the song just a bit.
Yeah, because that song, you know, talks about Joe DiMaggio. I mean, these are people in that,
right,
the era of the Roosevelts.
That's right.
So they just changed the words, and luckily the syllables were the same. That's right. This is a tune that Paul Simon himself has identified as one of the ones that he thinks is one of his best.
Met my old lover on the street last night. She seemed so glad to see me, I just smiled. And we talked about some old times, and we drank ourselves some beers. Still crazy after all these years.
I'll confess, I heard him sing this on the 40th anniversary celebration of Saturday Night Live. And, of course, he's been the most frequent musical guest on that program in the four decades of that program's existence. And I just wept my eyes out. Because for me and for those of us of a certain age, that we grew up with this music and with this guy. There's a staying power to his music that, of course, is the thing that separates all great composers.
But you weren't crying at the turkey suit, were you?
I was not crying at the turkey suit, which you devastated me when we talked about this the other day when I was down visiting the exhibition. The turkey suit is no more.
That's true. It was destroyed. But we have from the skit that he did on Saturday Night Live, where he is part of the Five Host Club. We have his Five Host Club jacket there. And the sketches from Saturday Night Live are clearly the most popular part of this exhibit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's, you know, done some great, great things there. This is a tune that a lot of people don't know, perhaps. It's not one of his more famous songs, but for me personally, it's a terrific song. He wrote in memory of John Lennon. This is one of the verses at the end of The Late Great Johnny Ace.
On a cold December evening, I was walking through the Christmas time when a stranger came up and asked me if I had heard John Lennon die. And the two of us went to this bar and we stayed to close the flames. And every song we played was for the late great Johnny Ace.
Interesting little connection to Baltimore. The orchestration of this string part at the end of this song was by Philip Glass, who is from Baltimore. And one of the violinists on this record is Maren Alsop, playing the violin on a Paul Simon album in the, I guess, the late 70s, the early 80s. You have a pop-up part of this exhibit. The main exhibit, I guess, is on loan from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That's right. We're the first stop on a national tour.
Yeah, but you've also got what you call a pop-up exhibition, tracing the lineage of Paul Simon as part of this very amazing group of Jewish singer-songwriters in the folk and folk rock scene in the 60s and 70s in New York. He is one of quite an impressive crowd of Jewish artists.
Well, when you think of Paul Simon, it's not that strong a Jewish connection individually. But then you say to yourself, Paul Simon, Bob Dylan, Phil Oakes, Leonard Cohen, Peter Yarrow, and the list keeps going. And the question is, why were so many people of Jewish heritage involved in the development of folk music? And we try to give some answers to those questions. And secondly, what difference did it make? What was special about this group of artists taken as a whole?
And one of the things that they all shared is that they were all frequently featured in clubs in a very specific geographical
right.
area.
There's about a 5-block area of Greenwich Village where all these people met. They got to know one another. And as I point out, The folk music revival, if its center had been Nashville rather than Greenwich Village, might have been very different.
A very different scene, yeah. I mean, Barbara Streisand was being discovered at this time.
Mort Saul, Lenny Bruce, mm-hmm. A whole secular Jewish culture was forming in New York.
And in a way, you talk about how all of these singers, you know, the Paul Simons and Dylans and even guys like Arlo Guthrie and people, sort of they really invented folk music because folk music heretofore had meant a very different thing. It had meant an indigenous music that was passed down
in an oral tradition. And so the young Jewish singer-songwriters and the entrepreneurs behind them were very much inventors, and that's kind of an oxymoron when you think about it. Folk music should be an oral tradition, but it's what enabled them to help push folk towards folk rock.
As we finish up, we just got a little bit of time. I'd love you to tell the story of Jack Holtzman, who was a student at St. John's College in Annapolis, and he used his bar mitzvah money to found
Elektra Records.
Isn't that amazing?
It was, and his company was kept afloat by a folk artist by the name of Theodore Bickel, who was a surprise success in the late 50s, and that gave him the resources to later feature Judy Collins and The Doors. All of that came because his company was able to survive off of a Jewish folk musician.
Yeah, and it all started with some very generous grandparents and friends at a bar mitzvah. Well, it's a lot of fun, this exhibition. So, Marvin, thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Marvin Pinkert is the director of the Jewish Museum of Maryland. If you're a music fan, you have got to check out their current exhibition. It's called Paul Simon, Words and Music. It opened yesterday. It'll be there until the middle of January. There are several lectures and events scheduled in conjunction with this exhibition, including Arlo Guthrie's sister, Nora, who's going to be speaking on November 22nd. We've got information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up, a conversation with Ann Tyler, whose latest novel, A Spool of Blue Thread, has been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Here's a little Graceland. Stay with us.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I am following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War. I'm going to Graceland, Graceland. Memphis, Tennessee, I'm going to Graceland. Poor boys and pilgrims with families, and we are going to Graceland.
It's Maryland Morning, and on Monday morning, we usually hear from theater critic J. Wynn Russick. This week, she has been to the Annex Theater's production of Insurrection Holding History. Here's her review.
How accurate is history? Ever. Even primary sources are no substitute for having lived in the same time, breathed the same air, as the people who made history. A PhD candidate experiences living, breathing history, nearly two-century-old history, firsthand in Robert O'Hara's audacious, time-shifting play, Insurrection, Holding History, at Annex Theater. Ron Porter, earnestly portrayed by Nathan Stephen Couser, is a doctoral student writing his thesis on American slave rebellions. In his first scene, Ron is visiting his great-great-grandfather. Yes, you heard that right. TJ, the great-great-grandfather, is 189 years old, a former slave. He's in a wheelchair, unable to move or speak. But Ron holds conversations with great-great-grandfather TJ. When they talk, a shaman-like mother figure, warmly played by Amma Brown, speaks for TJ, though only Ron can hear her. With her as his mouthpiece, TJ convinces Ron to drive him home to Southampton County, Virginia. When they check into a motel, Ron sees ghosts of Nat Turner, leader of the famous 1831 slave insurrection, and his followers threatening the motel owner and his family.
You people don't sense anything, do you?
Anything like what?
You people don't see anything coming, do you?
Nothing but you, Mr. Paul. Now it's early for all of us. Do you want to pay cash or charge it?
Odd as it sounds, the next scene is inspired by The Wizard of Oz and whirls Ron and TJ back to 19th century Virginia. Ron finds himself on a cotton plantation where TJ is a slave and can now talk to Ron directly. TJ, played by Dominic Gladden, wants Ron to see Nat Turner in action. TJ doesn't count on Ron inserting himself into events.
Promise me something, Ronnie.
I won't say anything this time. Don't worry, Gramps. I know nothing about...
No. Promise me you be safe. You live in a dangerous time, just like we do here, so you be safe, okay?
I promise.
Insurrection draws numerous parallels between the fate of African Americans then and now. Some of these are comic, some are frightening, some are both at once. References crop up to movies and shows ranging from Roots to The Sound of Music, as well as The Wizard of Oz. And a phone ringing today startles the characters in 1831. Most of the actors play multiple roles, male, female, white, black, straight, gay, young, old. S. Ann Johnson is especially adept at switching on a dime. One minute she's Ron's African-American aunt in the present. The next minute she's the white plantation mistress in the past. There is so much going on in Insurrection holding history, it might seem impossible to keep it all straight. Nudity, profanity, and at one point even the hokey pokey add to the play's bold juxtapositions and anachronisms. Some of the performances could be clearer, and it may take theatergoers a minute to catch up. But director Kyle A. Jackson and his cast, aided by Ryan Kidwell's sound design and David Crandall's projections, guide us through this complex material. Insurrection, Holding History, shows us that while no one can change history, no one can get it exactly right either. Even so, the effort to make sense of history may be the only hope not to repeat it. Until it moves to its new shared theater on Howard Street, Annex is performing in a temporary space on the corner of Park Avenue and Clay Street. It's a little off the beaten path, and so is this play, but both are worth discovering.
Insurrection, Holding History is at the Annex Theater's temporary space at the corner of Park Avenue and Clay Street in Baltimore until October 25th. Our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, has all the details. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be back next week with a review of the Olney Theater Center's production of Bad Dog. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Nathan, over to you.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at wypr.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@wypr.org. Now, back to the podcast.
The Man Booker Prize is one of the most prestigious literary awards in the world. It's given to a work of fiction written in English and published in Britain. When the prize was begun in 1969, nominees were limited only to writers in Britain, Ireland, Zimbabwe, and the Commonwealth countries around the globe. 2 years ago, the prize changed its rules to allow writers from across the English-speaking world, including Americans, to be considered by the panel of judges. Last month, the short list of 6 finalists was announced for the 2015 Man Booker Prize. The winner will be announced tomorrow. One of the finalists is Baltimore's own Anne Tyler, who was nominated for her latest novel, A Spool of Blue Thread. Last February, Anne was kind enough to invite me to her home in Roland Park, where the book takes place. It chronicles several generations of the Whitshank family, and Anne started by introducing us to the middle generation, Abby and Red.
Well, I think of them as the center of the current Whitshank family. As you say, they're the middle generation. It's a family of building contractors. They've been building houses in Roland Park and Guildford and Homeland for some 60 years or something like that. And Red and Abby are now, as the novel opens, they're middle-aged, and they're thinking about their old age. So that's where I begin the story.
One of the things I love so much about this book and all of the other novels of yours that I've read is that every character is likable. Is likability or sort of just general pleasantness in a character something that's important to you, or something that you think is good grist for a novelist to imagine their lives with?
I suppose it's not essential for every novelist, but it takes me about 2 years to write a book. So I'm going to have to be living with these people for 2 years, and I just don't want to live with someone I dislike. On the other hand, there have been a few people that maybe haven't behaved well in my novels. In fact, the patriarch of this family is not entirely admirable. But I'm okay with that as long as I find some inner reason for their behavior and begin to sympathize with them.
The other interesting part about this book is that it goes backwards, if you will. Did that particular decision to structure it that way, did that pose writerly challenges?
It began that way because I wanted to write a book that I never had to finish. I hate finishing books. I hate the turning in of the book, the editing process, the publicity process, everything like that. So I thought, well, I'm getting on in years. I could just write this book that never ends, and I could do that by having many, many generations. And then my concern was, yes, but eventually I'll run out of generations because, you know, I'll be caught up to date. And I thought, well, not if I go backward in time. So I'll begin with the current generation. I'll move back. And I think the earliest date that I actually show in the book is 1926. And then I suddenly realized that before then, I wasn't that interested in the people, you know. So I stopped the book. I had to end it after all.
And turning in the book really is tough. That hasn't gotten any easier for you, has it, in the 20 novels that you've written?
No, it hasn't. And beyond the idea of saying goodbye to them is the idea, in a way, they've been my imaginary playmates for 2 years. And to expose them to outside eyes and have somebody say something cool about them would hurt my feelings. So, you know, again, it's on their behalf. I think, well, I don't want people to misunderstand them or say anything censorious.
Another great character in this book is the house. Talk about the importance of place, the importance of the physical location of where people live and how they spend their days.
I think I'm very concerned with place in my books because I don't have much of a sense of place. I wasn't raised in one place or one house. So I very consciously anchor my characters in a place.
Let's talk a little bit about Junior Whitshank in the novel, Junior and Linnie Mae. Junior is the father of Red, who is married to Abby, and they have the four kids. Junior is almost obsessed with this house that is owned by a family named the Brills. Why is the house so important to Junior, and is the importance to Junior, does that at all reflect its importance to you?
Junior is from a background we don't know at all at first, and it turns out to be a very iffy background. So to him, the house is a sort of symbol of class, quality. He built it himself, so he knows it's well made, and he just wants to fit in. And one of the things that I say in the book, or have him think in the book, is something I've thought myself, which is we are theoretically a country without class, but somehow there's a bit around the edges that seeps in. So he never really feels that he's made it, but he clings to this house, which is the symbol for him, and which he longs to pass down forever to his family.
Let me do something that's patently unfair, and that is read you a quote that you gave to the New York Times in 1977. And Lord knows I wouldn't want to be reminded of things that I said 30 or 40 years ago, but you said something that struck me. You said, "It seems to me what I'm doing is I'm populating a town. Pretty soon it's going to be just full of lots of people that I've made up." What do you think of the town so far?
Oh, I'd like to live there. I'm fond of everybody in it. Why wouldn't I? I feel they're alive, to me at least.
Do you have a favorite citizen?
My favorite is Ezra in Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant. He breaks my heart, and I think he's a good man.
When you talk about time as well as place, I found that very poignant. Abby says something to the effect of that when you're young, time goes very slowly, and when you're older, time goes very quickly. And that's something that everybody sort of knows about. But you expand on it beautifully with an observation that I think is quite compelling. You say that we're old we're young for such a fraction of our lives, and we're old for many, many years. Time flies fastest for all those years that we're old. So in a way, it all sort of equals out. It balances out. Those observations, is there a way that they come to you? Is there a method?
When I begin writing, it's so mechanical. I have none of those thoughts. I'm just trying to move my characters around on the page. And there's a moment when they begin taking charge, which I do know how airy-fairy that sounds, but most writers say the same thing. The characters take over. So at that point, for instance, Abby might start talking about time and her view of time. And I'm basically sitting back and saying, well, isn't that interesting? I never thought of that, you know. I have been known to laugh aloud in my writing room when one of my characters comes out with a piece of dialogue, and it's not like laughing at my own joke. It's that they were talking and they said something I never would have thought of. I'm writing to see what it would feel like to be somebody else. And then when I get it down, I think, so that it feels real to me, then I think I'd like other people to see what it feels like to be that person too. And that's it. I don't care if they take away a moral or a lesson of any sort.
Novelist Anne Tyler. We spoke last February at her home in Baltimore. A Spool of Blue Thread is shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. The winner will receive £50,000. That's about $76,000. We'll let you know who that winner is on our next show Wednesday morning. I loved A Spool of Blue Thread, so personally, my fingers are crossed for Anne. Also on Wednesday's Maryland Morning, a discussion about the Democratic presidential candidates debate that takes place tomorrow night. Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland, Michael Fletcher from the Washington Post, and Republican strategist and blogger Richard Cross will join me, and we hope you can join us too. So until then, for Nathan Sterner, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.